You're listening to WPVM LP in Asheville, North Carolina. 103.7 on your dial and streaming globally at WPVMFM.org.
This is A Better World, coming to you from the studios of WPVM 103.7 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. And we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org. My name is McNair Ezard, and I'm your host for A Better World. Each week, we take an in-depth look at the people and organizations locally, nationally, and internationally who are working to create a world that works for everyone. And with Memorial Day upcoming, we have three special guests from Veterans for Peace, Western North Carolina. We have Jerry Werhan, who's the president of Veterans for Peace. Bruce Carruthers is a member of the local chapter. And Bruce is a U.S. Army veteran and served a tour of duty in Vietnam in 1967 and 68. And Chris Berg has been with the local chapter of Veterans for Peace for 13 years. He is an Army veteran who served in Okinawa around 1972 and 73. So, gentlemen, welcome to A Better World.
Thank you, McNair.
Thank you.
Good to be on.
Jerry, I didn't mention about your military service. Can you fill me in?
I was crazy enough to enlist in the Marine Corps before I got a draft number in 1971, and spent 2 years in North Carolina, total peacetime experience. A couple of years in the Marine Reserves, and then 19 years in the Army National Guard.
For listeners that might not be familiar with Veterans for Peace, can you, one of you, tell us about it briefly, about its structure and its mission?
I guess it's up to me to start that out. And you said I was president of Veterans for Peace. I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy. I'm only president of the local chapter, and that's just, I just say that jokingly,
okay,
because the whole organization is very well run and but challenged in so many ways, especially in the last few years, especially. But it's a national, even international organization of military veterans and allies. So it's not necessary to be a veteran to belong to Veterans for Peace, but we appreciate all the support we can get from anybody we can get it from who believes that peace is absolutely essential. But there's 140 chapters in the world and across America. The membership has grown to maybe 4,500 at the current time. And that represents quite a spike, and that's, again, attributable to what's going on in the world and getting the interest of veterans who want to resist what we're doing as a country around the world. And about a third, I think a third of the membership are non-veterans. So the point we try to make is we welcome everybody's support to in the mission of what we're trying to accomplish.
Does the national and the groups in other countries, do you tend to work on the same sorts of issues? And how do you go about here in Western North Carolina deciding what to focus on?
Well, some things are perfectly obvious. I mean, you can read it in the news every day there's something we need to attend to. But there's a national website, veteransforpeace.org, which is really the clearinghouse for all the information about the different projects, the organization, the board meeting minutes. There were total transparency in what is discussed and how our finances are managed, and working groups. So we have special groups that focus on various items or various issues that are relevant to peace and justice and the environment, et cetera. And that's really the go-to. And of course, they communicate with us via email several times a week. Both good news, the good news where we have a success, the good news that's heartening in that we are attending to something that's very important. And then some of the other news, which is basically background information on what is especially screwed up about the world at that moment in time. So we often feel like we're trying to sip water out of a fire hose mm-hmm. with the flow of information. And the same thing goes for our local chapter trying to communicate with our membership. We get lost in that fire hose of information. So it's kind of challenging, but it's totally essential work.
I'll ask you this again at the end of the show, but you have something upcoming on Memorial Day. Could you share about what that is in Asheville?
We're going to gather at 10:30 a.m. at the Western North Carolina Veterans Memorial in Pack Square Park, which is near City Hall and the big stage downtown. And I've invited upwards of 200 people to attend from various groups and individual contacts. And we will keep it simple. We're going to grieve the true costs of war and militarism, because it's too often that those things get lost in all the noise that's out there. And there's an awful lot that goes on that people either need to be reminded of or be made aware of in the first place. You can have conversations with people about one aspect of the military and war and bring up something, and they'll be totally blown away to know that this is what's happening.
Yeah, and one of those things I'll bring up right now is, in preparing for the show, I looked at a thing called the Global Peace Index, which is put out by the Institute for Economics and Peace mm-hmm. each year. And it looks at such things as I think it's 168 countries, the level of societal safety and security, the extent of ongoing domestic and international conflict, and the degree of militarism. Mm-hmm. And of course, the most peaceful countries in the world were Iceland, number one, followed by Ireland and then New Zealand. Back in 2018, the U.S. was ranked as the 103rd most peaceful nation out of 163. Then 2021, we were at 117th. In 2025, we're at 128th. Our neighbors to the north, Canada, of course, are ranked 14th. Mm-hmm. Israel ranked 155th, and Russia is at the very bottom at 163rd. I mean, based on this report, it certainly doesn't seem like the U.S. is headed in the best direction as far as trying to be a peaceful country in the world, does it?
No, it's very disheartening and very depressing, actually, that I can't remember who it was. It might have been Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who said that the United States, and he said this during his time in, I think, when he was in jail for one thing or another back in the 60s, in protest of the Vietnam War, that we were the most prolific purveyor of violence on the face of the earth. Whether it was direct intervention by way of war or the creation and sales and of weaponry and the support of other violent governments, et cetera. So we are, by all, rational measures, pretty much a violent nation when it comes to militarism.
Are you more motivated these days? Or discouraged? You see what's happening with the leadership in Washington and in the administration and at the Defense Department?
McNair, I won't speak at that level, but I will mention that it's always a challenge to go to our weekly vigils in downtown Asheville. A week or so ago, I was talking with a gentleman about our back and forth with Iran, and it turned out he was Iranian and had come over on some sort of business enterprise and just wanted to probe out what the chances were of understanding Iran in this country. And that felt, it's heartening to have a reach out like that.
So what can you tell us a little bit more about that conversation?
he wanted to know what we knew about the structure of the Iranian government that we were so busily trying to damage, but very ineffectively, and how the people in the absence of alternatives really continue to support the existing regime, and that by and large, I mean, there's always dissidents, but Iran is, it will abuse its dissidents, but he said that doesn't seem to have, you know, done anything toward the aims of your government. So I'm not real sure what you're doing there.
What I find it both discouraging and invigorating in terms of trying to convince people. But what I find most discouraging is how little people know about the history of Iran, the fact that it had a democratically elected government, and that the U.S. and the British toppled that because of their concern with the oil fields there. Iran only wanted a part of the profits that came from the oil, and we engineered a coup where the Shah became the leader. And of course, that led to the revolution there when it became an Islamic Republic. And they have plenty of reason, like many countries in this world, to distrust the U.S., not hate the U.S. And so I don't think people understand the history of this, that we've actually, the root cause of all of this comes from the actions on the part of the CIA and the British intelligence because of our desire for oil rather than being willing to share the profits of oil with the Iranians. And you try to talk to people about that, they either don't know about it or they don't believe you. A few of them are amazed and are willing to consider it, but generally, I find Americans are not willing to consider that, and they don't understand that the U.S. is probably, maybe could be ranked as a country that supports terrorism in one form or another more than any other country, because 700 military bases across the world, number one in arms sales, constantly promoting coups, constantly engaged in violence, either directly or indirectly across the world. And if they wonder why countries don't trust the U.S., it only takes a little bit of knowledge and, you know, some paying attention to the news to understand what's going on and why the U.S. is in the position it is. And of course, with the latest administration, I think that has been exacerbated substantially.
Can one of you talk about this notion of forever wars? Did it start with the so-called war on terror in the post 9/11 world?
Well, I attended a board meeting over the weekend, and there was some discussion and consideration that the forever wars actually began in the first Gulf War back in 1990-91, that if you go back to that, and that's the war that we came back from with all this glory and parades and all this other stuff, this was supposed to wipe away the scars, or whatever you might want to call it, of Vietnam. That's where it began, because you can put a through line of American occupation in that region of the world almost continuously through Iraqi freedom and Afghanistan and most recently Iran. But there's been continuous occupation all over that region with us, and a lot of stuff you don't ever hear about until there's something that the government can't put the lid on. Like if I think it was a while ago that some troops got killed in Syria. And so people, what are we doing in Syria? Well, we've been in Syria probably continuously for a very long time. And it's only when those things happen that people realize that we're so far afield. And then people forget, it gets washed away in the flood of all the other news.
Mm-hmm.
But we're still there spending money, you know, and lives.
Are both political parties in the U.S. at fault for letting this kind of perpetual state of war continue, do you think?
I think I'll comment, but I think Chris and Bruce have could corroborate, is that, the military-industrial complex heavily influences the behaviors of our Congress and the president. And so, you know, war is good for them. I mean, they'll blatantly come, the CEOs of like Raytheon will come out and just almost delightfully acclaim, we're having a wonderful year because we're selling all this stuff or giving it away. Regardless, they get paid for it. And it's just the way it is. You know, it's just like Eisenhower warned us when he was exiting office as president, that it was going to work its way into every level of government and every county of the United States, the military-industrial complex. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Congress just goes along with it. And they've abdicated so much of their, you know, constitutional responsibilities in recent decades, you know, by failing to hold the president account for, you know, starting a war and not explaining why he's doing it and going beyond the 60 days that the Constitution requires that it be decided upon by Congress. So there's all that.
If you just joined us, you're listening to a conversation with Jerry Werhan, Bruce Carruthers, and Chris Berg from Veterans for Peace, Western North Carolina. And you're listening to us at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. Okay, that's The Young Rascals, People Got to Be Free, from the album Freedom Suite.
Here, can I make a couple comments on
your
questions and the answers that Jerry gave? I think, you know, in modern times, you might be able to go back to the Gulf War. But if we go back far enough, I think the U.S. has been in a state of war, I mean, almost continuously, if you consider westward expansion and the decimation of Native Americans, our continual interference in Latin and South America. But certainly since modern times, since World War II and the beginning of the Cold War, we've been either involved directly or indirectly in some kind of conflict in what maybe started out as an ideological contest between the Soviet Union and the West, but ended up being pretty much a blood sport. Played by grown men to know better. I mean, you know, Korea, Vietnam, all the conflicts that we've been involved in. So I think people don't appreciate that the U.S. is a warlike country and tries to say that we promote peace, but that has not been the case. I mean, The invasion of Cuba, the Philippine war, all those things. Secondly, on this, whether Republicans and Democrats are equally responsible, with a few exceptions, maybe Bernie Sanders, AOC, Democrats go along with the budget. And in fact, Congress often gives the Pentagon more than it asks for because people want projects in their districts. So, yeah, I think both parties are equally culpable for our military-industrial complex, the size of our military, and our continued engagement in military conflicts across the world.
Yeah, I read about something called the Iron Triangle, which has to do with this self-reinforcing loop involving the Defense Department, congressional defense committees, and major arms manufacturers. You know, that the lawmaker wants defense contracts for jobs, and manufacturers want to make a profit, and military wants weapons. I don't see how, with such a system so strongly in place, how do we ever make a switch to something VFP talks about, which is a peace economy?
Well, I know there's another dimension to that Iron Triangle that you mentioned, and that's the think tanks that the sit in Washington or wherever and, you know, play out all these different scenarios. And they try to devise, you know, foresee what could happen and how they can profit from making it happen or making things happen. So it's just that complex. And seems to be impossible to unravel.
Let me ask you guys about Jerry and I were talking before the show about the cost of war. Of course, if anybody's been watching the news, they know the price tag on the Iranian conflict that's ongoing right now, and which is quite huge. And Bruce mentioned about the number of foreign bases the U.S. has, which has, of course, has a price tag. In addition to the financial cost, what are some of the other, what do you consider some of the other costs, like to a society, to the U.S. society, like in terms of economic losses that the rest of the society experiences?
Well, speaking of our current policies by the administration favoring oil and gas producers, it's very strange that we took the aggressive action in the Gulf that we did. As best I understand it, the president was advised that this sort of thing would be liable to disrupt the flow of goods out of the Persian Gulf, and indeed it has. And my understanding is the forecasters are saying this may actually result in a quicker transition to solar and battery style energy production. So, I mean, it's kind of self-defeating policy, and it's very, very odd, but, you know, militarized, as you say, and that's part of the probably part of what got us into it.
I mean, theoretically, I would think the cost, the money that goes for militarism is taken away from things like education and healthcare, but not that the government would ever fund those things in full, but it, I mean, just ideally, you would think that money could be used for something here at home.
Well, I think the biggest thing is it's money that we don't have to begin with, and that currently the national debt, you know, forget the deficit part. That's just like off the table, off the graph completely. But the national debt is skyrocketing because we are spending this kind of money with paired with tax cuts, so that we don't even have adequate revenue to fund our government's most basic functions. And then we go and we start whizzing away money on a war in Iran. Just one example is the last time I heard it mentioned, is it was from a hearing last week with Secretary of Defense Hegseth, where the financial guy from the Pentagon, who had already said it was costing $21 billion so far, in just the course of a week, updated that to like $29 billion. And seeing how that was a week ago, who knows what it is today, how much we've spent on Iran. And just as an example, if you diverted that $29 billion into public education, you could completely modernize learning environments, especially in historically underfunded areas. And there's all kinds of examples of tremendous improvements in the lives of our citizenry that the money cannot be spent on because it's being wasted in Iran and elsewhere around the world. And then you consider that the president wants an extra $500 billion, which is half $1 trillion. A number I can't even figure out how many zeros are involved in that number. But it's just incredible that we'd be willing to spend or be thinking about spending that amount of money for destroying other countries and other peoples. And, you know, some, depending on the day of the week, he might be threatening to destroy an entire civilization. Mm-hmm. And here in West Asheville, we have homeless people, you know, sleeping on the ground at the edges of the parking lots because there's not enough, you know, money being spent to alleviate that kind of suffering in our own country.
I read one figure that said when factors like debt and rebuilding military inventory and veterans care are taken into account, that the cost of the Iranian conflict will ultimately exceed $1 trillion. And like you said, where's the revenue going to come from since there's a tax cut?
It doesn't seem to come from anywhere but deficit spending. And, you know, this whole thing, our involvement in these wars and the deficit and the spending on the military, I don't know if the American public can appreciate what's going on now. Trump's ratings are low, but that seemed to be based a large part on inflation and on the cost of gasoline. But the opportunity cost here, what could be done to reduce the deficit, to support healthcare, education, all of that is just seems to be lost on so many Americans. I can't quite fathom that. One of the things that I've said to many people and is often unpopular is that if we had a draft again, conscription instead of a voluntary military, a lot more people might take interest in what's going on if they're worried about them, their sons, their daughters, their friends, their brothers, you know, their siblings, having to serve all around the world and being faced with this, that people might pay more attention like they did during the Vietnam era. There was a movie that was that Roger Moore did, where he started asking people in Congress if they were willing to have their son or their daughter serve in the military. And of course, after a while, they just avoided them. They didn't answer those questions. So I don't know. It's a puzzle to me that people don't appreciate what could be done for this country if this money was not put in the military. I mean, the economic cost of it is incredible. Just if you take the deficit alone, what that's going to do to our grandchildren. But if you start talking about healthcare, about education, infrastructure, I mean, even if you don't want to support things like healthcare because you think people should take care of themselves, our infrastructure, what could be done with that money for infrastructure alone for bringing manufacturing jobs back to the country? I mean, all that is just, it's not something a lot of people seem to really consider, and it's kind of hard to get that message across to them.
Do you think that there's any kind of link being made in people's minds between high gas prices and what's going on with the war in Iran and Strait of Hormuz? I mean, maybe people might start making the connection between their own pocketbook and the militarism that we're engaged in.
Yeah, I think so. I think polls show that people are really upset about and they don't understand the point of this war and that it's really hurting their pocketbooks. And that seems to be what gets to people more than anything else are pocketbook mm-hmm. issues.
But that's also disheartening that people don't put a moral dimension to it. Right. The rightness and wrongness of it that simplistically gets equated with, oh my God, I had to put $80 worth of gas in my pickup truck today.
Exactly.
And, you know, the fact that, you know, in the course of you driving that pickup truck around until you were empty again, and there was probably dozens of innocent Iranian citizens killed or injured while we were bombing. That should be the bothersome aspect of this whole thing, and not so much, you know, the inconvenience and cost of gas, mm-hmm. you know, oil being what it is.
Do you think we, as a country, the normal citizen tends to become complacent about the militarism that goes out from this country?
Well, I was going to bring up a quote from one of our BFP colleagues up in the national organization, and it had to do with there's a organization that opposes the militarization of our youth, and there's a YouTube video about what they're doing to do that to kind of dissuade people, young people, from considering the military. But basically, he says that this presentation is a sobering antidote to the militarism we all breathe in like air. Mm-hmm. And that was just, you know, that just basically hits it on the head. We are just so military, you know, so prone to militarism. You know, before the interview, I was going to go look for on Google for Memorial Day sales near me and read off all the options you could exercise on Memorial Day to go spend your money on new mattresses and get all these mm-hmm. other things versus going to do what we're going to try to do on Monday is grieve the direct use or the direct cost to our own citizens, you know, through their deaths and disease and suicides after serving, as well as the same kinds of damage to the rest of the world society, who, you know, because of some of our misguided wars, have suffered even more than our country has suffered.
If you look at, and I've seen several studies by maybe The Guardian and Intercept, if you look at how the mainstream media has addressed our wars, until things go badly, they all support it. They're all on board. They think it's wonderful. And so what you get, like Jerry said, in the air, you get this idea that, yeah, this is a just war. We should do this. And people get really excited about it. They forget the lessons of the past. So, I mean, I have to agree. We're a society that supports militarism, that seems to like us going to war and glorifies the idea of being a soldier. At the meeting on Monday, I want to talk about the town I grew up in, which was a small town at that time, only 7,000 people. And 8 people from that little town died in Vietnam. And one became a Marine, one was a paratrooper, one signed up for officers training program. It was this whole idea that there's some glory in war and that it will be, a glorious exercise. And I think a lot of young people think that. They see that, they watch these movies, video games, they think that war is a great thing until they get there. Many of them, then they realize how horrible it is, but seem to forget that lesson pretty quickly. And it doesn't seem to be a lesson that takes with the American public. A large section of the American public, anyway.
So when we come back from the break, I want to ask you about another area of cost, the human and psychological toll, which you and Jerry kind of touched on. And if you just joined us, you're listening to a conversation with three folks from the Veterans for Peace, Jerry Werhan, Bruce Carruthers, and Chris Berg. And you're listening to us on A Better World at 103.7 WPVM.
Sometimes you gotta keep your head on and keep on trying. And if you feel the urge to raise your hand, you can start a revolution or start a
Okay, that song is Peace is Free by Blackstone Cherry from their album Folklore and Superstition. And today on A Better World, we are talking to the folks from Veterans for Peace. We've talked a little bit about the financial cost of militarism, and I want to get some input from you on the human and psychological toll. I hear a lot more these days because of my work about moral injury, PTSD, that sort of thing. So maybe, Chris, could you lead us off on talking about what are some of the costs in this area of militarism?
I'll mention one thing. After being a service person, I eventually converted to Quakerism, the Friends, which is a peace congregation. And they have as one of their activities a Quaker house in Fayetteville, where Fort Bragg is, which supports 2 full-time counselors on a GI rights hotline. This is to try and assist service people who've run into snags in their situation or have moral concerns or have injuries that they don't feel are being dealt with properly. So that's something that is a response, and I hate that it has to be, but it looks like that kind of service is needed.
The suicide rate among veterans is substantially higher than it is among the general population. And the concerns with military sexual trauma, PTSD, burn pits, traumatic brain injuries. All of those are results of the war. I mean, the psychological damage it does to the veteran, but the psychological damage having a warlike country and atmosphere and militarism does to the general public, I don't know how you can measure that, but I think it's pretty substantial that we think in, it might be a stretch, but it seems to me that somehow related or transfers into this sort of general anger that so many people, Americans, have and so much hatred they have for people who are not like them. I mean, for immigrants, for brown people, whatever. It may be hard to make a connection, but I feel there's a connection between our sort of constant and being engaged in warfare and the sort of mindset that people have that violence is a way to solve problems.
I was reading an article from the Journal of Mental Health and Clinical Psychology about the psychological cost to military personnel who are engaged in remote warfare. And that's something you didn't really have to deal with during the time of the Vietnam War. But now this shows high rates of burnout, moral injury, and PTSD from people that are, you know, running drones and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Just anecdotally and locally, there's a young man who's a member. Well, he's not that young anymore, but he's in his 40s, but he's an Iraq war veteran who works on the medical staff at the VA hospital in Asheville. And soon after the Iran war started, he spoke at church about just that week. Two veterans had committed suicide in the parking lot of the VA. So there was, I mean, I'm speechless to consider that, but, you know, they were seeking treatment or whatever for, and they just got triggered, so to speak, by what was happening in the world. And, you know, from your own experience, all of us, that, you know, there is a moral injury aspect to this. And if you feel like you're complicit in that, you're going to feel like maybe you don't deserve to live either.
I've wondered about that idea of moral injury. If the people that are involved in, say, the bombing of the boats in the oceans of Latin America, and, for instance, the school children that were killed in Iran, military people that were behind either the decisions or carrying out the actions, what sort of moral injury might they be experiencing at some point? Mm-hmm.
There was a wonderful play we saw, one person play, a woman's play called Grounded, some time ago in Asheville. And it is a woman who was a pilot and then was assigned to these remote drone locations someplace near Las Vegas, I think. And she talks about how she went through this change, killing people remotely, and ended up targeting a person who was supposed to be part of the Taliban, maybe. End up killing his wife and his children, and how she ended up being court-martialed. I mean, it was a great evolution of the sort of moral injury, how she felt about being involved in this in a remote location. So that's a point, and I think that's probably something that will become the VA will deal with on a more frequent basis as we have more and more warfare as drone warfare, it's not even personal warfare for people who are involved in the military.
Post-Vietnam, was there help available for military people that were experiencing PTSD or moral injury, or was it even known as such back then?
You know, not immediately. The VA was run during a lot of part of the Vietnam War by World War II veterans who often tended to look at Vietnam veterans as losers. I mean, they lost their war, they were drug addicts, they were not man enough to win the war. Sometime in not too long after that, the VA started what are called these vet centers. They were separate from the hospitals, and they were generally staffed by Vietnam veterans or Vietnam era veterans. And that kind of opened the door to people being able to go into these places to get social and psychological help with what they were feeling from being in the war. And that has changed quite a bit now. I think the VA now does really try to welcome people who feel this moral injury, have PTSD, and it really has much more of an evidence-based treatment for people who are experiencing trauma from being involved in the military. So It was not initially available to Vietnam veterans, but over time did become. And by, I would say, by the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s, it had really started transitioning into being a more welcoming environment for veterans.
Did it take a while to convince the VA system that this was a genuine concern?
Well, yeah, it took a decade anyway that it was a genuine concern. It had a lot to do with the changing of the guard, of some of the older World War II veterans leaving and younger veterans coming in who had a greater appreciation of what that did. And that's not to say, of course, that a lot of World War II veterans didn't face the same kind of moral dilemma, but it was that kind of mindset that, you know, you just tough it out. And that is one of the issues that veterans face now. Military personnel, if you start complaining about having moral qualms, it affects your career in the military. And of course, it's an all-volunteer army. So part of the problem is that I think people in the military now feel bad about complaining because they signed up for it. When I was in, I was a draftee. So, you know, my attitude was I didn't ask for this, but I just assumed not be involved in it. So I had no compulsion complaining about what was going on and, you know, being somewhat vocal about it. You had to be careful. You couldn't be too vocal or you're going to get in trouble with your commanding structure. But I think it's very difficult for people who volunteer for this than to complain about it afterwards. And I think that might be part of the difference.
So let me ask you about, you know, we not only is we have a military that gets everything pretty much they ask for and sent on excursions around the world. And I don't think people tend to think too much about this, about the militarization of agencies here at home, such as with ICE. And I was wondering if one of you could talk about that idea and how and how it affects our civil liberties.
Well, the civil liberties, you know, if you dress up and equip, you know, normal, regular police and, you know, build a culture of them being warriors instead of defenders of the peace, you know, peace officers. Remember they used to call cops police peace officers?
Yeah.
I don't think they do that anymore. Some municipalities, I've seen examples on TV of police departments that seem to truly be compassionate caretakers of the people they police. So I don't want to generalize, but the government had a program. It had a number. I don't remember what it was, but they, and this is the military industrial complex at work here, they seem to be taking almost brand new equipment, declaring it surplus, and then giving it to municipal police departments around the country so that they could show up at crime scenes or whatever they needed to do, or just ride around in town in a beefy, you know, macho looking vehicle with all the body armor. And if you look at a police officer now, it's not Andy of Mayberry. It's somebody that's bulked up with armor and stuff hanging off of them. And, you know, it's amazing. And so it's not much of a leap to go from getting used to seeing that and then having them told to go and track down people of color and all kinds of things that we already know too much about. Well, we don't know too much about it. We don't know enough about it, but we know enough to see that it's wrong and have them feel empowered to do whatever they want. And, you know, the killings in Minneapolis are perfect proof of that, that, you know, those folks were, by all accounts, except, you know, it seemed like all the proof was there that they were not a threat to police or ICE agents, and yet they're dead. And that's the ultimate violation of your civil rights.
Yeah. Chris, since you mentioned about being Quaker earlier, do the Quakers get involved in the anti-war movement, anti-militarism? Mm-hmm. As an organization, as a faith-based group?
Well, not there are arms of Quakerism. The American Friends Service Committee is pretty well known for doing community organizing, including making a presence in behalf of Palestinians, for instance, as a domestic in migrants who have been from time to time persecuted, including very lately. Another group is works with migrants to do, you know, social service and placements and stuff like that. Also, attempts to kind of emulate the Peace Corps and do it with a more not pacifist exactly, but constructive community building aspects. Supporting many friends, actually, are the majority of World Friends are in Africa. So we do have connections with that kind of social development.
You're listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. And we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org. Hey, that's Neil Young singing Rockin' in the Free World from his album, Freedom. Since we are in the last quarter of the hour, I wanted to ask you about this idea that, you know, a lot of folks say that we need a strong military for world stability. I mean, critics argue that U.S. military hegemony and its acts of intervention create global instability rather than, you know, stability, and supporters say you need a U.S. military for maintaining international order. And I was wondering, can you speak to that, please?
Who wants to go first?
I think it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So we think we need a big military. We add, other people add to the military as a result of that. It's kind of a spiral. So do we need a military for self-defense? I think you could reasonably argue that. Do we need an offensive military that where we spend more than any other country in the world, where we project our power over the world? I would say that we don't need that, that it's a detriment to society, it's a detriment to world peace. You know, it kind of precludes what VFP supports is negotiation and not military intervention. So, I mean, I'm sure Chris and Dura have opinions about that, but I think it does the opposite. It makes us a bully. It makes us think that the first effort ought to be military. And I just think a lot of other countries respond to that. I mean, I think they're afraid of the U.S. They respond to it militarily. So I don't think that it promotes peace in any sense. In fact, I think it does the opposite.
Jerry, Chris?
Well, there's an old saying that says if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And, you know, that seems to be, you know, these nails pop up around, you know, the world, and we just want to go in with a hammer and supposedly solve it that way. But, you know, the thing about, you know, obviously the war in Iran is the primary focus of our disdain right now. But, you know, truth be known, there's been low-level similar stuff simmering the entire time we've, you know, who knows, since forever. And so we're seeing, though, and, you know, for people who finally are starting to wake up, they're seeing, you know, $29 billion. What kind of human misery could be addressed with $29 billion that would prevent all of the strife that we're trying to squash with $29 billion worth of weaponry? It's just the thing, that kind of thing. And I had a conversation a couple weeks ago with a Democratic, a fellow who told me he was a veteran, he was a Democrat. He had never voted for the current administration, but he supported him in his efforts to deny Iran the bomb, the ability to use a develop and deliver a nuclear weapon. And I said to him, I said, his own director of national intelligence told him a couple of years ago that they were nowhere near being a threat to anybody else. And this gentleman, he stuck to his opinion that it was worth $29 billion to prevent Iran from developing that bomb that nobody, you know, that ostensibly is not even being pursued by Iran. So I just don't get it. And if we show up these days, you can't blame the world for saying something, uttering a profanity when they see, you know, American warships off their coast and, you know, our aircraft, you know, flying overhead.
Chris, is it true that, you know, it seems like in America that the position has been that we need to, like, flex military muscle, but at the same time use diplomatic efforts to solve a problem? But I wonder, though, does that reliance on military force, does it not undermine diplomatic efforts?
Well, I certainly agree, and I find it very confusing that the current administration seems to put so little of its moral or even financial energy into diplomacy. They don't seem to respect that, and that may be a personal attitude of the commander in chief, and that's very worrisome. We've got to make connections with people on the ground in areas where we have concerns. I also know some people that go regularly to Cuba to try and do religious and other kinds of ministries there and try to alleviate some of the suffering, basically, that our sanctions policies have created. And military ability just does nothing for that kind of situation.
We're getting kind of towards the end of the hour, but I wanted to have you talk again about what's coming up on Memorial Day.
Well, we're going to gather. I think you may know Billy Jonas. He is a friend of the chapter and has performed at numerous events. And thank goodness, because he puts the icing on the cake in terms of community building in the spirit of what Veterans for Peace is all about. And he draws the crowd. So he'll be there. We have planned to have five individual chapter members talk about each one will talk about briefly, because it would put you to sleep if it was other than briefly, some of these true costs of war that are not readily apparent to most people. We're going to have a time of reading. We're going to have the attendees provide the names of people they know who have died in war. It'll be read aloud and honored. And then there's going to be time for brief eulogies of the war dead by people who want to offer that up to everybody in attendance. And that's generally what we're trying to do is grieve, but also celebrate the number of people who will congregate in community with a common spirit of opposing war and militarism, which everybody needs these days. The No Kings activities and all these other things that take place around the periphery of those in between times are extremely heartening and extremely necessary for our spirits these days, because the rest of the time is just so oppressively depressing. And it's just important to look each other in the eye and say, we're going to fight this, and we're going to move beyond.
And that's tomorrow, Memorial Day, at, you said, 10:30?
10:30 a.m.
at Peck Square.
It's the little monument on close to College Avenue where there's a statue of a seated woman on a bench. That's where we gather.
Well, like if all of you could take a stab at this question, if you would. I once read a quote by the Dalai Lama who said that, and was about peace. He said, peace means solving these differences through peaceful means, through dialogue, education, knowledge, and through humane ways. Do you think humanity, that we will ever get to this way of resolving differences?
It's, you know, it seems almost impossible to contemplate that, but it's not so absolutely necessary that it motivates me. I mean, because one example, when I was in Desert Storm, I spoke in to Iraqi soldiers who, you know, they were played up to be our mortal enemies. And they were in our medical care. And I learned from talking to them that they had been forced from their homes at the threat of death to their families into the trenches in Iraq to endure the bombing, or else they would, you know, their families. And it turned out we were just the same character of schmucks whose country sent them off to do the war, you know. And that was a turning point for me, because there was no demonizing people who were victims like that by their government, which is what we sort of do too.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to send people to war if you can convince them of the inhumanity of the opposing side, right? Isn't it?
Correct.
Bruce, Chris, could you comment what you think?
I like to be hopeful, but given our histories of species and what we're doing, I can't help but be skeptical that we'll ever do that. I mean, I would like to think too. The quote that you gave was good, but it also involves compromise. You don't always get everything you want, and so any sort of negotiated settlement requires both sides to be willing to compromise. Consider what are their primary interests, what can they give up? Jerry told a story. I told my sons, I have three of them, when they got old enough, they said, well, what was it like to be in the Army, to be in Vietnam? And I said, well, this is what it's like. I said, you're carrying a weapon and your goal is to kill people that you don't know and you have nothing against. And these are people that are trying to kill you and they don't know you and you have nothing against, and you really want the same thing. You want a peaceful life. You want to have a family. You want to be able to make a living. And so if we could somehow understand that everybody really wants essentially the same thing, and there's a way, there's so much wealth in the world, there's a way for everybody to have a decent life, I think we could do that. I don't know how to convince people of that, but I think that's what people have to understand basically in order to resolve things peacefully and for everybody to get some of what they need and some of what they want.
Chris, would you like to comment?
Yes. Well, a couple possibles. One is we get to learn more about how to behave well together if we invest ourselves in being good to each other and recognize where there are problems with mental health. That kind of study is so valuable, and it can make the problems more workable. This even includes understanding our own brains. I understand now they have figured that the idea of vengeance, which is so pervasive in DC, may be connected to certain connections in our brains. So we are learning. I hope we learn more.
And on that note, I want to thank Jerry Werhan, Bruce Carruthers, and Chris Berg, all from Veterans for Peace, Western North Carolina. So thank you for coming on the show today, and all the best to you, and thank you for the work you do through Veterans for Peace.
Thank you, McNair.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Beautiful.
You've been listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is McNair Ezard. Thank you for joining us, and hopefully we'll see you next time on A Better World. And we're going out today with Fleetwood Mac singing Peacekeeper from their album Say You Will.